I'm Sarah McConnell, and this is With Good Reason. We often call music a universal language. We like to believe beautiful music like Schubert's Ave Maria communicates the same meaning across cultures, but it's not always the case. Take this piece. For us, it's a holiday classic, conjuring bubbly champagne and midnight kisses. But in Japan, you're likely to hear it at least once a day because it's the closing music for virtually every department store. Or how about this?
Regrets, I've had a few. But then again, too few to mention.
Frank Sinatra recalls the sounds of Las Vegas lounges to American ears. But in the Philippines, this song is dangerous to play in karaoke bars, where arguments over My Way have claimed more than a dozen lives.
More, much more than this, I did it my way. Yes, there were times.
If music like this can conjure such different meanings in different cultures, what does it mean when music gets more political? Today on With Good Reason, we're exploring the politics of music, from the colonial archive to hip-hop diplomats. First, Noel Lobley wants the world to hear African music of a certain era. He's a former radio DJ and an ethnomusicologist at the University of Virginia. He has a problem, though. Many of Africa's historic music recordings are locked away in dusty archives, far from the reach of the continent's new generation of musicians. So lately, he's been strapping DJ tables to donkeys' backs and giving Africa's old music new life in the streets. Noel, when did you first fall in love with African music?
I was working as a professional DJ in clubs and on radio decades ago. And in 2001, I think, a friend of mine, an anthropologist, invited me to go and join him and travel and live in Kenya for 3 months. It was my introduction to anthropology, how you hang out with people, how you work with cultures. And the natural musician in me started to apply that to music and following a lot of music locally throughout Kenya. The mix of tradition and modern, how it was everywhere, how in the smallest, tiniest churches it would be blasting out on the streets. You'd hear like hip-hop music being played in situations you wouldn't expect it, like elder communities listening to it. And it felt like it had a special place to me.
So what happened after Kenya? You went back to London, sort of a changed man.
Yeah, came back determined to work with, to study African music, to find out what was underneath it, the culture that made it. After a long pathway, I studied ethnomusicology back at the University of Oxford in England. So during this time, I knew African music, I knew world music from the more produced side of things, you know, what we hear on radio, what's on record labels. But I became aware of these field recordings, these like snapshots, moments that are recorded in context, music, in the place where it's actually made rather than overproduced in a studio.
Field recordings by whom?
Field recordings by different collectors, anthropologists, private collectors. The one that really turned my ear and head was a collection recordings made by Hugh Tracy, who was an English pioneer collector, ethnomusicologist, who in the 1920s moved to southern Rhodesia, as was, and fell in love with the local music making and devoted the rest of his life to trying to record all of the music making of sub-Saharan Africa.
Is there sort of a treasure trove collection of his field recordings in Africa from the 20s, 30s and on?
So he established the International Library of African Music, which is in Grahamstown in the Eastern Cape of South Africa, the world's largest archive of field recordings from sub-Saharan Africa, like 30, 40,000 recordings, 200 language groups, 18 countries. So that's an archive now. It's a teaching institution. But when I was first introduced to it, I could only find little tiny fragments online.
Give me an example of an early fragment you found that just thrilled you.
One that stayed with me, stood out so strongly in these early days of listening, was a recording of a Laziba mouth bow played by shepherd boys in Lesotho.
Will you play that for us?
We'll listen to a short fragment here. So what you're hearing there, there's two people. The Laziba is a mouth bow. It's a stringed instrument that you blow rather than pluck. So the main musician you can hear is vibrating a vulture quill in his mouth.
Using a vulture quill?
A vulture quill that sort of vibrates, and with just sheer skill is able to pull out a fundamental note, a main note, and a whole series of kind of scorched overtones. You can also hear whistling, and the expression happens at the kind of the grumblings and the mumblings, they all happen at the same time as playing the instrument. Sonically, it's so rich, it's so physical, it's so visceral, and I've built an instrument like that. It's very, very hard to play. It's aesthetically stunning, but it's to communicate with animals, it's to communicate with space, it's very much of a place. It's also, it features on the national radio in Lesotho as well, as part of the, I think it's just before the news or so. So it's kind of got an iconic symbol within the country as well.
You're kidding, really? That plays on the national radio?
Yeah.
Fascinating.
Yeah. When I first started hearing these sounds online, I responded purely as a DJ and artist to the sound, the quality of the sound. To me, it sounded like acid house music, you know, which I grew up on. The distinctive sound in acid house is distorting a bass line, a machine that distorts a bass line, and it makes this whole... It's been described as squelchy. The acidic sound is this kind of coruscating, scorching sound that it just electrifies clubs. Having grown up on that and been involved with that scene, I had the same reaction to what I could hear in the Laziba here. I'm not saying the traditions have influenced each other, but sonically there's something connected there, I think.
After you became so moved by the archival sounds from African music that you found, you went back to Africa. Tell me about the experience you had with a donkey cart and cassettes.
Sure. So it struck me that this wonderful collection was unknown outside of academic circles, and it mapped history amongst 200 different communities in South Africa.
What do you mean it mapped history?
It was recorded at a time when music and culture was hugely changing, this kind of rural to urban migration that was happening, people going to work on mines. So it was massive social, cultural upheaval and change. It's supposed to be a moment of celebration of indigenous music and culture. So what interested me was working with local artists, local black South African artists, and whether this record would mean anything to them. And I was lucky enough to meet Nyakonzi Matsana, a professional musician and choreographer, dancer, who when I met him was teaching kids to dance hip-hop, and Kholile Madinda, a hip-hop artist and rapper. I said, do you want to come and hear this archive? And they're like, yeah. And we came in, we listened to it together. So some recordings are like, yo, this is our anthem. We still all sing this today. And it was recorded in the 50s. It was surprising to them to know that that record existed. And then as we went over time, we kind of drew out recordings that we thought might be of interest to people. But these were locked up in an archive. And they opened my eyes to methods that could expose the recordings in the townships to local communities. So they're like, if you want to get these things heard, hire a donkey cart. We'll travel around singing the songs on the donkey cart. We'll set up a PA system and we'll DJ them. We'll DJ the old recordings. We'll DJ house and ragga and hip hop. We'll do performance and people will come. And so we did. And they did come.
How many communities did you visit?
Probably dozens of different townships in surrounding areas. We got responses from hundreds and hundreds of people.
And tell me, you were playing old songs or you're playing new songs?
We were playing recordings from the Hugh Tracy collection. So nearly all of these recordings, the ones we were using, were all recording amongst Xhosa communities, XHOSA, in the 1950s by Hugh Tracy, the collector. And we were playing those to contemporary Xhosa communities today.
Give me an example of one that really excited some of these communities to hear again.
Okay, so this is Soma Gwaza, recorded by Hugh Tracy, the English collector, in 1950s. This is actually recorded in Mpondoland, a community in the Eastern Cape of South Africa. So Soma Gwaza. When I was going through the collection with Nyaki and Kholile, Nyaki was like, yo, this is our national anthem. Everyone knows this song. We sing this. And he told me what it was, how it was used. What he was surprised him was that it had been recorded 50 years earlier or 60 years earlier. He's like, people want to hear this. They want to hear this. So it became one of the selection of songs that we started to share with people. And it was the one that was most well known. It was still performed a lot today. But what was fascinating about it is that Hugh Tracy writes a couple of lines in a catalogue about it's a praise song for the chief after he slaughtered a cattle. So that's what Hugh Tracy would have been told by someone. And it across time and in different communities, it means so many different things. The debates, the different perspectives on what Soma Gwaza was as a song, what it meant to people, was utterly fascinating.
What does that word mean?
So Soma Gwaza, well, this is it. Soma Gwaza is something like father of the stabbing, father of the cutting, something like that. It's because it's most strongly associated with an initiation ceremony, a circumcision ceremony, which is called an umgidi, which is still practiced a lot. And it's quite controversial in some ways now. But people debated about who had the right to sing it, what it meant, who Soma Gwaza was, what the history of it was. It led to these whole kind of like storytelling, like it ignited the people's desire to communicate about who they were.
So you lived and traveled around South Africa with these songs and these musicians for a whole year?
For an entire year, yeah. Watched this method of kind of sharing them with people. But as the project has continued, I work very, very closely with the International Library of African Music to consider different projects that work with contemporary audiences. One response has been to team up with a record label to reinterpret and remix some of this history and artists.
And is that the project called the Beating Heart Project?
That's the one, yeah. Beating Heart is a record label based in London.
So recently, Beating Heart released an album. Tell me what's on the album and how we should receive it.
There's two parts to the album. There's the Malawi originals, recorded by Hugh Tracy in the 1950s, the field recordings, and the remixes, 21 remixes done by international and Malawian artists. So they exist side by side. And the international artists, many based in London, from the sort of electronic dubstep house scene, have responded very, very strongly to these original recordings.
So give me an example of an original piece on the album and also a remixed piece by one of these modern groups.
So let me play for you here. This is a song recorded by Hugh Tracy in Malawi in the 1950s, 1957. It roughly translates from Chua as money is the devil. So the musician is Betty Kamanga, recorded in 1957, playing the bangwe, which is a raft zither, a stringed instrument that's played by hand, and he's obviously singing at the same time. Rhythmically, very complex, very warm, so it sounds so warm. And the topic, he's singing about the problems of money, what happens when you leave your community and go and work on the mines in Johannesburg. There was huge rural to urban migration at this time. So let me play for you now the remix that was done of Money is the Devil. This was remixed by Rudimental, a London-based, very successful, very, very well-known house electronic 15-piece group. The The album was released, the Beating Heart Malawi album was released in June 2016. I was in London. We had a few launch parties in London, and I was back there for the whole of the summer and could see the influence it was having on radio and clubs.
How were London dance audiences responding to this?
It's gone down really strongly at festivals, Glastonbury. People really gone for the sound. And I say the story behind it because Beating Heart is trying to work by using this sort of international profile of artists and the electronic house scene to help invest back in local community projects. All of the artists on Beating Heart Malawi work for nothing. It's a non-profit label, and the proceeds are investing back in local communities in Malawi. So in this case, with Malawi, Beating Heart is working very closely with the Garden to Mouth program, which does sustainable nutrition programs in schools in Malawi.
Do you worry that even in these days, in spite of the excitement and the chance to release it to a wider audience, people outside of Africa are still appropriating that music for their own excitement and musical purposes?
Absolutely. It's a very, very pressing concern and question. To sample the rest of the world, to feather your nest, is a neo-colonial pursuit. What's exciting about something like a Beating Heart project is the attempt to be collaborative, to work with the international music industry, but closely with anthropologists, local communities, and kind of get that conversation and that collaboration right. And the collaboration is the most important thing. You know, it's the equality of the exchange, and it's very, very difficult to achieve that. That's the challenge and the exciting challenge.
Noel, this has been wonderful. Thank you for sharing your experiences and music with me today on With Good Reason.
You're very welcome. Thank you for having me. Thank you for your interest. And let me just play one more song.
Right as we go out.
This is Ndamu Temba Nyanja, a kalimba, an mbira. You know, people call it a thumb piano, but it's an mbira. This was recorded by Hugh Tracy in Malawi, again in the mid-1950s. It's a cyclical form, so you get repeating cycles. But within that repeating cycle, you get stunning, infinite variety. And the moment you hear and experience the music fully, it moves from hearing a loop into like a spiral moving through time, so you never hear the same thing again.
Noel Lobley is a professor of music at the University of Virginia. You can find out more about the Beating Heart Project on our website, withgoodreasonradio.org. Coming up next, hip-hop diplomacy.